You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is the CRM Archaeology Podcast. It's the show where we pull back the veil of cultural resources management, archaeology, and discuss the issues that everyone is concerned about. Welcome to the podcast. Hello and welcome to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 217 for June 16th, 2021. I'm your host, Chris Webster. On today's show, we talk to an early career archaeologist about how she got into this profession and where she's going with it. The CRM Archaeology Podcast starts right now. All right, welcome to the show, everyone. Joining me today is Heather in California on a boat.
Hi, everyone. Sail anchors away, right?
Sail away,
but that sticks. So, yeah.
Yes.
Anchors away.
Anchors away is the Navy. Yeah, there you go. So, it's summertime and things happen. So, it's just Heather and I today. But if you heard our last episode with Tallulah, she's a new archaeologist. Her and a friend were listening to the CRM Archaeology Podcast on their way to her first CRM project and her friend's second CRM project. And as a response to that episode, you know, I put it over into one of the big Facebook groups that we have for archaeology and said, hey, we want to talk to other people who are, you know, at the early stages of their archaeology career, not necessarily their first project, but, you know, maybe the first few years, and just talk to them and see how they got into this. So one of our important commenters for the Archaeology Podcast Network is Amy. Amy, welcome to the show.
Hello.
So longtime listener, first time interviewee, I think is what you're supposed to say. I don't really know. This isn't a radio show though. But yeah, Amy's been listening to us for a while and is one of our, you know, one of our early members into the Slack team. And I think you won a lifetime membership through an Archaeotech podcast contest that we had and is commenting on our stuff. So you are the model of what all listeners should be. So thank you for that.
Yes. First off.
You're so very welcome.
So why don't we start out by just learning a little bit about you? You know, what did you do? You know, and you don't have to get into specifics if you don't want to. Tell us as much as you want. But what was your life like before archaeology? Because like Heather and I, you came to archaeology not out of, you know, high school and then college, but a little bit later in life. So let's just talk about, I guess, what led you to this decision.
Okay, well, I was working at a job. As you said, I'm not going to get specific, but I was working at a job as a manager and it was getting very monotonous and I was bored with it in a way. And I decided to go back to school. I had went for a semester or two right out of high school and thought to myself, school's not for me. I'm just going to go get a job, which is what I did.
Yeah.
And years later, went back to college, used a few of my credits from when you go to junior college, because that's where I started was junior college, you kind of take one of every class to figure out what the heck you want to do because you're starting over. And so I went everywhere from, I took a horticulture class, psychology, you know, I don't know, so many different classes. And when I finally took physical anthropology, intro to physical anthropology, I said, this is what I want to do. And so from that point, any semester you could look, I probably had like four anthropology classes going on until I transferred. Nice. Yeah. So yeah, I wasn't feeling fulfilled with my previous job and just wanted to do something that was more along the lines of what I felt like doing. So here I am.
Well, great. And when did you first hear your first episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast?
Okay. So after college, I'm going to backtrack just a little bit. I went from junior college to a state school. And then from a state school, I went directly to grad school and spent a year at grad school and got my MA, which is not in archaeology. It is in visual anthropology. And then after that, I worked in film and television for a while. And I still wanted to do archaeology. All that time, I just wanted to do archaeology. So I had no field school, which is hard to get a job without a field school. So I decided to to sign up as a volunteer for the Passport in Time or PIT project through the Forest Service.
Yeah.
And
a lot of friends have gone through that. It's a great program.
It was eye-opening for sure. So on my drive down to go to the PIT project, I was trying to find something to listen to. And I found the CRM ARC podcast, and I probably listened, I don't know, whatever the current episode was at that time. So it was in 2018, and then went backwards. And then before I got to the site where I'd be camping for a week, I downloaded a million episodes. So I'd always have something to listen to in the middle of nowhere without service. And so that's when I first listened to it.
Nice. Nice. In college. So you got interested in anthropology by, you know, taking a physical anthropology class. Obviously, CRM in Southern California is very different than physical anthropology. Sometimes there's a lot of monitoring, and it's just because of the California laws and regulations. So I know, right? Yeah. How did you find out about CRM and then go towards CRM as a career path versus, you know, a number of other ways that you could go within the anthropological, I guess, sphere of classes and disciplines?
Okay. Well, as I said, I was listening to the CRM ARC podcast. And to be honest, that is really my first exposure to CRM.
Really?
Yes. I believe that when I took a maybe methods and theory class in college, because I did take a bunch of archaeology classes when in undergrad.
Yeah.
The degree I got in anthropology as my undergrad was a broad degree. So we had to take X amount, like same amount of art classes, same amount of physical, same amount of cultural, same amount of linguistics. So it was very, very broad, which I believe you said that that's kind of how your undergraduate was as well, or someone on one of the podcasts.
Mm-hmm. I think most of them are like that. The idea of the four fields of anthropology is important.
Sure.
Most colleges try to retain that concept.
Yeah. So I'd taken the basic, you know, method and theory class, of course, the intro to archaeology class, and some other classes, one on the entire United States, one for Great Basin, and I think one more somewhere in there. But throughout all those classes, maybe once, and for like, I don't know, 17 seconds or 20 seconds, there was a single line on a slide that said, something about CRM. It honestly, I had no idea what CRM stood for. And it mentioned a school where in California, and maybe I want to say like Sonoma State, they have a program for, but I could be wrong. That was mentioned. And then that's literally my college coverage of CRM. But that's it. Wow. I graduated in undergraduate in 2014. And I went to a PIT project in 2018, which is when I started listening to your podcast. So 4 years, that's how long it had been that I had no idea what it was.
Wow.
So that's how I figured out what CRM was.
Yeah, I don't think we should be surprised, but it's still shocking to me. I don't understand when the purpose of going to college to get a job, right? To get a degree, and then that leads to a job. Yet there's this, I don't know, but there's this ignoring of a whole facet of work, which is actually, you know, where a majority of archaeologists are working. It's shocking.
Well, yeah, and you're more likely to get a job in CRM, whether you've got an undergrad or a master's degree or not. You're more than likely to get a job in CRM than you are in academia. I mean, somebody's almost literally got to die for you to get a job in academia, because departments are shrinking, not expanding in most cases. So a lot of times positions are just being eliminated. So it's not surprising. And your experience, Amy, of, you know, basically one line on a slide is almost identical to mine, where I got my undergraduate degree. And it was only by the luck of Hurricane Katrina happened to go through New Orleans in the fall of 2005. And I happened to be back at my university because the year before we had organized a whole bunch of money and campaign and stuff to get basically Jane Goodall to come visit and give a huge talk at the university.
That's cool.
And I went, and I went back for that, of course, since we'd organized it the year before when I was a senior, or I guess my last year in college. for my undergrad. And I just happened to be there when a guy who was from that town had to leave New Orleans because his whole entire apartment was flooded and the CRM company he was working for, their offices were flooded. So they basically shut down for a few months and he came back and I was like, yeah, I don't know what I'm going to do. It's like, I'm going to Africa for a field school. That seems pretty cool. Doing that right after the Jane Goodall thing. And he's like, well, if you check shovel bums. And I was like, what the hell's a shovel bum? And that's essentially, cause I didn't remember learning about CRM in my undergrad. I look back on it and I was like, I have almost no memory of it. And the rest is history. I worked in CRM ever since. So if it wasn't for that hurricane, I don't know what I'd be doing.
Yeah, I started just like you, Amy. I started in community college. And like we mentioned before, this was my second career. And so I was an older student. And I think I got very, very lucky that my professor had been in CRM for quite a while he was in graduate school. And so he was a proponent. I mean, he was a realist and a proponent for CRM. And so I was introduced to it right away. And I was a single mom at the time. And so, you know, the reality of having to actually work, find a job that I could actually make money, not just continue to, I don't know, hope that I can get a job in academia, which I actually ended up doing. Mm-hmm. I'm very grateful because the first thing he said was go and get a job in CRM. Even if you end up going into academia, it will serve you well.
Right. So Amy, I mean, we're going to go a number of directions here, especially in, you know, segment two, but I'm curious, having been doing this for a couple of years now, do you, and you know, let's speak honestly here, because sometimes CRM is really hard, right? Do you regret your decision at all right now? Or are you still excited by all the different directions that CRM can go? Because I know people do get disheartened by where they end up at one point, but not realizing, you know, early on, people who are early in their careers, and I know you're not like this, you're definitely looking at other sources, but people early on are like, oh, this project sucks, ... my whole career and life sucks. Right. Not realizing that the next project will be completely different, or the next company you work for, or maybe you get a job in, you know, a completely different region or something like that. But given your experience so far, I'm just wondering where you're at with your decision to go into CRM.
Let's see. I am still in a good place. Yes, I do have those days where I just want to take a shower and go to bed because it was 110 outside, you know, I do have those days. I do a lot of monitoring. So, so it can be a little bit boring at times, but I mean, there's so much, I use a lot of my time when out in the field, especially during monitoring, to learn about soil or from the geologist that's there. Or to learn about whatever from someone else. I fill my time and I'm not learning while I'm out there. So I think that's one thing that's kept me at the level, because literally every day I go to work, I learn something new. And
yeah,
it's kind of amazing to still learn something, right? That being said, I do know that there's a lot of things that I still need to know. Being kind of newer, never having gone to field school, never actually, you know, getting a degree in archaeology or even a concentration in archaeology as an anthropology degree. Mm-hmm. I didn't do all that. So I don't have all of that background. But I think leading up to when I finally got a job in CRM, I was, I don't know, taking the free courses on Section 106 that someone offered, or doing, taking a course on CEQA, or, you know, even though it was just a PDF file that was put up there, you know, who cares? I learned something that day. Reading books, I've filled my time to try to get to where I feel like I should be, maybe at my age, like where I'm at age-wise compared to like everyone else in the field. I feel like I should know a lot more. But I do, you know, I do have experience, like life experience, which helps me with relationships. I have pretty good like conflict resolution skills. I'm sure that's from being a manager, you know.
Yeah, I'm sure of it.
And all of those things benefit me as well, where I know that the younger folk, mid-20s, early 30s, they're still learning a lot of those things. So I'm like one up on that section, but I got to catch up in the other section. So,
well, I will tell you what, you know what, I think you listen to the Archaeotech podcast occasionally, and on the episode that Paul and I just recorded on Thursday, that's coming out next Thursday, we talked a little bit more about the fact that, you know, he's got a PhD in archaeology from, you know, 25 years ago. And then when his son was born and his daughter was born, he was just like, I've got to switch my careers because I can't afford to raise a family doing this. So, you know, he ended up working completely outside of the field of archaeology for the last 21 years. Now, he's kind of kept a toe in various ways. And, you know, he's kept an interest in it for sure, but hasn't worked in this field for that long. Well, due to various circumstances, he's, you know, leaving his job at the end of this month and retiring basically and going into CRM. And his first project is with my company on this project that we're on out here in northeastern Nevada. So he's going to a completely different place. And I told him on the podcast when we were recording this last week, I was like, listen, you know, he's got some anxiety around it, you know, like as you would probably would understand. And he's like, you know, I'm just going to be a field tech. It doesn't matter what education I have. I got a lot of learning to do. And I was like, Paul, you can just about teach anybody to do field survey. I mean, it is not that hard, right? You learn how to look at, you know, different things. You can learn recording. You can learn all that stuff. That'll come with time. But it is really hard to find people who are responsible, who yes. know how to ask questions at the right time, who know how to manage themselves, who know how to, you know, be professional. That is a hard thing to come by. And to me, it is more valuable than any other skill you learned in school in an anthropology degree. And it's just that all that stuff can be learned. And it's just it's really hard to find people that can manage themselves that way. So Heather, I'm sure you can agree to that.
Yeah, I was going to say that. That, you know, everything that I'm hearing you say, Amy, is just like music to my yeah. ears. I would love to, you know, anybody with that kind of attitude where you're always trying to learn. And that is something that is just, it's key. You know, I think I've said it before, you know, the three magic words in any science, but in life in general, is being able to say, I don't know. I mean, that's where you learn. Yeah. You can't learn if you're not willing to say, I don't know. And that's also where you have that, you know, it's understandable. If people are insecure, they go into a new position, they are afraid that somebody's going to find them out, that they don't know everything that they're supposed to know. And, mm-hmm. you know, for me as an employer, I love hearing people say, I don't know, as long as they back it up with, I don't know. But I am willing to learn. I want to learn, not just willing to learn. I yeah. want to learn. I'm going to do what it takes. And, you know, the fact that you are taking that initiative to not only say, oh, I want to learn, but you're finding opportunities to learn. It's just like, it's tremendous. It's, and it is rare, unfortunately, that kind mm-hmm. of attitude. And I think that right there is such a huge commodity for you that I no doubt you're going to be successful in this. I believe it. I have one quick little story. When I was in graduate school, I worked my way through graduate school teaching upholstery, boat upholstery, car upholstery, and I taught in an adult school. And one of my first jobs that I had was with a really well-known, very well thought of firm in mm-hmm. California. And I was very nervous. And this was my first survey. It was out in the 29 Palms area. And I was just very nervous. And I knew they were going to take me to task, but somebody had, you know, recommended me, whatever. So I went out there, and it turns out that that area was so full of a bunch of, like, you know, a lot of old encampments. It was old prospector area. And you would not believe that I ended up being probably one of the more valuable people on the team because there was so much furniture out there. We were able to date some of the sites in a range based on the type of furniture that was there. I knew everything about the inner workings of furniture. And it just shows you who knew that my experience with upholstery was going to give me the life experience I needed to be successful on that job. And so it's just, you know, I think that when you have people that go straight through academia, and that's great. It's, you know, it's not a wrong path. But it also doesn't mean it's a better path, because the fact that you've lived life and that you've had other life experiences, just in a general sense, then also, you know, archaeology is about culture. It's a material culture. And so the more experience in life you have, the more reference you have to making, you know, making decisions on, you know, what you might be looking at. And so I think I think there's definitely a, to me, for somebody who's returning to college and this is a secondary career for them, I think it actually should be looked at as a positive.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think on that note, we will take our first break and then we'll get Amy's thoughts on all that and continue this discussion on the other side. Back in a minute. Welcome back to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 217. And we are talking to Amy about her, you know, new career in archaeology and CRM archaeology. Now, I'm curious, Amy, first off, you know, Heather and I were gushing about how we like people who like to learn and stuff like that. I just got to make a comment about monitoring. I actually haven't done a whole lot of monitoring in my life. I've done some, but I not like some of you Southern California archaeologists who just monitor because of the way California works. I just haven't worked that much in California. And the work I have done was on like the big movie bases and because of this other contract I was part of, and it was all survey. So very, very little monitoring in my career. But that being said, it is great that you're taking that time to actually learn and do stuff. I mean, the monitoring I have been doing, I was, you know, reading or, you know, listening to an audiobook or doing something. Because for those that don't know, maybe there's some people on the East Coast, because there's not a lot of monitoring that happens out there either for the most part. But maybe there's some people listening. When you're monitoring, it's large spans of inactivity punctuated by short bursts of excitement.
Yes.
And a lot of times you just don't have anything to do, right? Yeah. Until they come over to you and say, hey, we found something. Or if there's, you've got to actively watch some ground disturbance maybe or something like that. But you're typically there as just, you know, just in case. And it can get real exciting at sometimes. And, you know, the weird thing is to me, and I don't know why this is, but they always tend to put like new people out on monitoring, which I've never understood, because you are the only person out there. You have to know how to do everything and make all these determinations. Yeah,
exactly.
My first experience in the field, besides the pit project, was a monitoring project. Yes.
Right. Right.
I know exactly.
I'll tell you why. I mean, just from a business sense, for me, what I think is that, you know, a lot of times monitoring happens real quick. It's a response to a discovery.
Mm, yeah.
You can get a crew for a survey, for an excavation. Those are, you know, the shorter projects where the monitoring tends to last a long time and you have multiple projects that you have a need for monitors for extended periods of time, all, you know, simultaneously. And so because of mm-hmm. that, a lot of times you got to get somebody out there. Another thing is, you know, because just like you said, with California, there are areas where monitoring is part of the mitigation measure. A lot of time, I mean, I try to be very careful who we put out there, but there are times where it's ridiculous that we have a monitor out there. It really is a ridiculous mitigation measure. It's all fill. We've had more and more where we're having agencies just to CYA, and they're imposing these crazy mitigation measures on, you know, on projects to just to cover themselves when they're disturbing imported fill soils, you know, silly. So
That's always been my experience. Yeah, too, is exactly that. I didn't actually mind the monitoring I had to do here in Nevada. It was interesting. I actually stood out there most of the time and just and watched the bulldozer go back and forth trying to see if I could find anything. Of course, I was a new monitor. Like, I'd never monitored before, so I was really excited by it. And I remember one time when I had to monitor a couple sites in some old sugarcane fields down in South Central Florida, which is horrific, by the way.
Yes.
I don't know. Bugs. I don't know what happened. I know. We didn't see anything for like weeks. Like, I'm watching these bulldozers, literally nothing. And then I stopped for a coffee on my way out one time, and it was a long line, and it was just, and then there was traffic, and I was probably 45 minutes later than I should have been. I'm never late for anything. So this was a rare circumstance. And I was probably about 45 minutes late getting to, and also I got lost getting to where I was supposed to be out in the sugarcane fields, because these network of roads, the map, the bulldozer driver, literally drew me, was not very great. And I just, like, it was just a whole bunch of circumstances. I know. And then I get this phone call from my boss in Tampa. Uh-oh. And she's like, where the hell are you? They found something. And I was like, oh, son of a bitch. I was literally almost there too. Like, if she'd have waited just a minute, because the guy called her, because I wasn't there. And it turns out it was a cow skeleton and he didn't know. But anyway, yeah, that was the excitement of the time. So yeah, let's talk about some of the other stuff. I asked you for some questions like I usually do of all interviewees, just to you know, talk about some stuff that you guys want to talk about. And you talked about ethnographic documentary. I almost said that. Documentary. An ethnographic documentary. Why did you not pursue that? Is this something you were studying in grad school, or what's the story there?
Yes. So my degree, as I said, my graduate degree is in visual anthropology, which my focus was on ethnographic documentary. So I submitted my thesis as a documentary with a small paper. So just as much work, let me tell you, than writing a thesis.
Yeah.
And let's see, why did I not do that? Well, going backwards a little, when I was looking to go to grad school, I wanted to go to grad school for archaeology. All archaeology programs required field school. And at the time, yeah, I had an 11-year-old, I think he was 11, maybe 12. And for me, the money was an issue, taking mm-hmm. time off of work, because I also worked full time while going to college and being a mom. And granted, I wasn't a single mom. It was still like, I didn't want to leave my baby, you know, yeah. I was 12, like I didn't want to leave him for months at a time. And so it was a decision that I made when applying to grad schools to find something else that I was interested in. And another part of anthropology that I find fascinating is, and this kind of goes along with archaeology, is ritual.
Ooh, ritual.
Let's see. So in undergraduate, I was also a religious studies minor, just because I find religion fascinating. And so mm-hmm. When I was applying to grad schools, a lot of them were cultural programs. When I selected this one, it was because I could create a documentary on some type of culture, and I wanted to integrate a religious aspect to that. Just because that was what I studied in school, right? Doing that, the whole process, I was in grad school for a year. So from the time I started at orientation until I submitted my thesis was, I think, 5 days short of 1 year.
Wow, that's fast. Yeah, where was this?
This was at USC in Southern California, in Los Angeles, rather. So not to mention there was a lot of student debt that went along with that one too.
Yeah,
so I was just trying to hurry up and get it done. And, you know, taking, I don't even remember what grad semesters are like. Are they 8 units?
Six is units? Usually like, a full time.
Okay. I think I was doing 15 units a semester.
Jeez.
And then in addition to working on the thesis, and the program that I was in was set up as a 1 year program. So it mm-hmm. was, take 15 units, and then you have 3 months to film or interview, prepare, film, edit, do your sound recording, like all of that. You have 3 months to do all of that.
Jeez.
So it was pretty intense. Again, I was working also. So on top of that, and I had a, at this point, probably a 14, 15 year old. So that program, I think being so intense, I did want to do something like Nat Geo or, I don't know, like something on the History Channel, maybe. Mm-hmm. That was the kind of the route that I wanted to go, but I didn't know a whole lot about the film industry. And so right after college, I started to work in film, but I was in film, not recording film. I don't know if that's, I did a lot of background yeah. work in movies and TV, just because I wanted to get familiar with what set life was like. And then I kind of got sucked into that, and I did it for 2 or 3 years. So that was kind of interesting because it was nothing to do with anything I just spent so much money on school for. It was just more like exciting. Like I got to be on TV every week, and I got to every once in a while. And, you know, it was fun and exciting. But then I realized, man, I really got to like be an adult and get a real job. And so from that point, you know, I transitioned, but it was just, I didn't like set life from behind the camera. I think I liked it more like being on camera. And that's why I didn't really pursue making films. So, yeah.
There's definitely still time for that in your archaeological career, because we've talked about this. Yeah, we talked about this on other shows before. And I think we talked about this during the SAA forum that I was a part of. And one of the things we were talking about was presentation of, you know, archaeology in the media and things like that. And I was, unlike a lot of people who are very down on TV appearances for archaeologists, because I, as somebody who, you know, runs a podcast network, I've been approached many times. And I've currently never been on TV. Must say something about my interviewing skills when they ask me about how I'm going to be. But anyway, I'm also pretty critical of the storyline and what it's going to be and things like that. But that being said, I really think that we should take all those opportunities, even knowing that they may misrepresent us, because we need people like us, people that are archaeologists, but that, you know, can have this presence on there in order to show the world that, hey, there's real people out there doing archaeology. And, you yes. know, it might be some wacky show occasionally. But that being said, I think we all know, our professional colleagues know, that, you know, you got to take some of that with a grain of salt, and they're probably going to edit us down to something that maybe misrepresents us a little bit. But that being said, we're still doing overall good. So I'll just say, if you can keep a toe in that industry while you're still being an archaeologist, an opportunity might come up for you to, you know, match those two up, which would be fantastic.
Well, I'm sure there's some ways that you could integrate visual anthropology with archaeology. And yeah. I was thinking about this the other day. A lot of times, as part of, I don't know, I'm not sure what it's called, when you're working with a tribe and you need to do some sort of like public archaeology,
mm-hmm. public engagement,
mm-hmm. yeah, engagement, like having a film about, you know, whatever you're working on and the tribe that's involved with that, or that is from that land, you know, that would be fascinating. As I think it would be a lot more interesting than having like a town hall meeting as your yeah. public engagement, to be able to watch a film, which, I mean, ultimately, when I, as a learner, I'm one of those people that I learn visually, but I also learn yeah. auditorial. Yeah, I'm the all learner. Like, I like to have all the things. Like, I like to see, you know, hear and do, right? Yeah. So having video or film or something that explains like what's going on or what happened in this area at some point, that helps me retain the information more. And I really think it's sad that there's not a whole lot more film, I suppose, like that for people to learn, like just every, you know, lay people, not just archaeologists, but yeah. everyone in general.
I think some of it is because people feel like it's been saturated, where there is all this, you know, it's the allure of archaeology, and that there is a lot of documentaries out there, but it's not about real archaeology, really. I mean, you have the Nat Geo and everything, but just like you said, it doesn't help in a practical sense when you're trying to communicate something from, you know, on a visual and audio side, when it comes to public engagement and the public understanding the importance of the history of the area, not just what they understand, but mm-hmm. what did actually exist. And, you know, our company has put a lot of effort into that. The one hard sell on that is that, you know, when it comes to CRM, you know, it's the almighty dollar. What the client's willing to pay for. And so, you know, it's nice when, you know, company I have that I work for is a, you know, mid-sized company. So there are some things that we can absorb into our profit margin that include some of this audiovisual type of approaches to communicating what it is that we learn. And, you know, every time that I've used the talents of those on our staff that do that audiovisual component of communication, the client has loved it. It's been an excellent, you know, for them, it's an added benefit. But when it comes down to a proposal, that's the first thing that's going to be cut. It's not necessary. It's for them, and it's not what an agency is requiring of them. But I think, you know, the trick to having that become more of a normal thing is that companies are investing in understanding there's different ways of communicating what it is that we do.
Yeah.
It's going to have to come from that end first.
All right. Well, I've got some things to say on that score for sure, but let's take a short break and then come back and wrap up this discussion with Amy in a minute. Back in a second. Welcome back to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 217. This is the third and final segment. And I just got to respond to what we were talking about at the end of the last segment there with, you know, producing video and stuff like that. You know, sometimes you just have to make it happen, because like Heather said, who's going to pay for it, right? Like sometimes nobody. And until we can start doing different things in our project budgets that don't cost the client more money, but they can make us more efficient in other ways. And maybe we can siphon off some of those funds to do some stuff like this. Maybe, I don't know, but that's a hard sell because, you know, that extra money that you get from saving money on a project just ends up going into some other project. So, but you know, like the reason the Archaeology Podcast Network exists and the CRM Archaeology Podcast, which was my first podcast, is because there wasn't one out there, and I wasn't going to get a company to pay to teach me how to podcast and how to edit podcasts and do something like that. I had to learn all that on my own. I ended up taking a professional podcast engineering school certificate kind of thing at some point to flesh out my skills that I had just learned on my own. And now I have kind of a side business of producing and editing podcasts for other people. But like I'm saying, you know, Amy, with your experience and your, you know, degree and experience doing this, sometimes it just has to start out a passion, you know what I mean? And then it can turn into a thing. But, you know, we all have busy, busy schedules. But man, I wish we had more people in this industry that had those kinds of skills so we could maybe even get those kind of people together to start doing some stuff. And then hopefully, you know, the dream is to get compensated for it at some point. But sometimes that doesn't happen right away. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think a lot of what we do ends up, it starts off as a passion and an interest that we do on the side, and then ends up, you know, you find, eventually you do find a way to make it work or to, you know, benefit the project as a whole. I mean, I think there's been many times that, you know, we've used that audio visual. You know, if a company looks at it from a marketing end, mm-hmm. it is a much better product, you know, that you're giving your client. And when they see the benefit of how that communicates to the public during, you know, public review meetings and such, it's worth it in the end. But again, it's a hard sell until they actually experience it in person.
Amy, have you thought about doing any visually related film projects or anything like that? Anything that's bouncing around in your head, just don't have the time for?
I have, but I've had the thought of it. Right now, currently, I'm dealing with boxes and moving and realizing that when you live kind of in the middle of nowhere, you have to have 100 feet of clear brush from your house.
Right.
So I'm working on all that stuff right now, and it's going to take me a while to be able to do anything else besides work and work on my house. So
yeah, I hear you. And I misspoke earlier. You're in Northern California, which, man, the brush and wildfire potential up in Northern California is real. So yeah, definitely work on that 100-foot barrier.
Yes. Yeah. And I'm right up there in the foothills now. So.
Yep. So it's beautiful country up there, but man, yeah, it can get hot and it can get fiery. So, all right. Well, let's go back to a few of the other questions here. So you went back to school for GIS. What prompted you to do that? Other than what we've learned from you is you like to learn things, but you know, there's a lot of people in CRM that ended up going towards GIS for various reasons. And what were yours?
It was kind of just to learn something.
Yeah.
Not just to learn something, but I know that GIS is important in archaeology. And I feel like it's something I could use outside of archaeology.
Sure.
The program that I'm taking is through a community college. So I don't know what I was thinking last year, working 40 to 50 hours a week in the fall semester, and then also registering for 12 units of classes. That was, it was a little insane. So this past spring, I did 2 classes only, so 6 units, and worked. And I'm glad I only did the 2 because I was trying to just knock it out. It was 10 course certification. So I have six down. I got 4 more to go. But the 2 I took this past semester, man, they killed me. It was on, I learned Python, which I am not experienced with, so Python for GIS. And then also did some remote sensing, which was, I felt like that was going to be like my class. And it's all about like photo, like drone photos. I said drones, yes. Although I didn't do that, but working with them, like on the computer, I was thinking, man, I'm going to be so good at this. And it was so hard. I cannot even like, it was so hard. I can't even express how hard it was. I mean, I did well in the class, and, So I don't know. I felt like that was a good skill to have. And I'm hoping that where I work, they're going to utilize the fact that, you know, I'm working full time. Actually, last week, I think I put in 60 hours. So that was kind of a rough week with moving and going to school. You know, it's tough, but I'm doing well. And I hope that they utilize these new skills that I'm going to eventually have. I mean, I have skills now, but I don't have the quote unquote certification yet. That won't be till next spring.
Well, I will tell you that, you know, be careful in CRM, unless it's your goal to become like, quote, a GIS person full time. Companies will push you towards that. If they find out that you know something that's a little bit more niche, like GIS is, or, you know, there was a time back in the day when, you know, I was the only person on a crew that knew how to run a total station. And so guess what? I'm the total station guy now for this entire project. And I'm just about to pull my hair out because I don't want to do that. Like, I'd rather have some help with it and I can just do it occasionally and I can get back to some excavation. But, you know, they will exploit that. And as long as, and if you want that to happen, that's fine, but just be careful. If you want to get back in the field, you want to do some other stuff, you know, let them know that and say, hey, you know, that I did this so I could enhance my skills, not pigeonhole myself into one area, you know, again, unless that's what you're looking for. Cause there are people that, you know, love GIS and just want to do that all the time. So there is that.
Yeah. I would say it depends more on the size of the company. So Amy, I just had a quick question. Yeah. If you don't mind sharing, what size company are you working for right now?
It's fairly large.
Okay. So typically with GIS, it's excellent. It looks great on a resume and it's really good to be able to have that skill that you can use and not be limited if you need to manipulate things or you have to understand something. Or even in California now doing in-person record searches, you have to have some understanding if the IC you're using has digitized records. Now you have to understand GIS. So those things that makes, you know, makes it easier. But in a larger company, they generally have a GIS department that's very focused just on GIS. Actually, when I got the job that I work at now, I shouldn't say the job, but when I started working for the company I work at now, way back when, I was hired on as 40-40 or 40-60. I was 60% archaeology. They were using my human osteology experience and a lot of, you know, analysis and work. And then 40% of it was GIS. And that's actually how they were able to kind of sell my position in a company or in a smaller office. But as, you know, time has gone on, that kind of, I've actually had to promise at times that I would not do GIS, but it always serves me well because I come from that perspective. I understand GIS very well. And so now, you know, I'm able to communicate with the GIS staff. And so it will never serve you and never go wrong. But if you're in a small company, exactly right what Chris is saying, you are going to get pigeonholed because a lot of people don't have that experience and that knowledge. If you're in a larger company, they're generally not going to use it, to be quite honest with you. In a medium-sized company, you'll vacillate. It just depends on how much they've invested in their GIS department and whether or not they need you to do things. But the one nice thing is not having to wait in a medium-sized company, not having to wait for GIS to get freed up to do your work. You can kind of hop in there and do it, you know, is definitely an added benefit. But it's just something to think about, exactly what Chris is saying. If you start working for a smaller company, you will likely get pigeonholed into, you know, doing some of their GIS work, which is maybe what you want. Yeah.
That was kind of originally my thought process was I did work for a very small company. The company that I first worked for was small. I was one of two architects that was on staff. So, I mean, it was, and that's all it was. It was just archaeology. And he had someone that did his GIS work for him. And originally my thought process, so I guess this answers the previous question, why did I do GIS? If I did work for a smaller company such as that again, I would then have, I guess, give the owner or, you know, whoever does the budget, they don't have to pay someone additional to do GIS work because I would know how to do that. Since then, I've started working at another company and yes, they do have a GIS department. They primarily do all of the work that has anything to do with a map. And so I don't know where I'm going to go with this GIS information, but I will have it. And so maybe, as you said, Heather, I'll be able to better communicate with the GIS department, like what I need in this yeah. map that you're going to make me, because I know I've been on email threads where it's like, I need this map of our project area. Here's all the stuff. And then they come back, well, this thing looks just like this thing and this thing, right. where I would know that they need that extra information.
So absolutely.
I would give it immediately.
Yeah. GIS is it having, and that was the selling point in hiring me, was that, you know, I could be that liaison between the GIS need and the archaeological, you know, having that archaeological perspective or knowledge and being able to communicate what it is that you needed on that figure. It's, you're right. It's a lot more efficient. And now, you know, I work in the company. There are times where I'm tapped to kind of figure out symbology or to figure out, you know, how GIS can be used. My thesis for a second MA in GIS was based on predictive modeling. And so that has come into play. You know, I have used that quite a bit. And even if the GIS department does it, they still don't have the knowledge of why it is, you know, what is predictive modeling when it comes to archaeology. And so you're exactly right. I mean, you're on the perfect track. I think it can never serve you wrong to gain more knowledge. And especially if you want to eventually to get a full-time job, it'll serve you well.
Yeah. All right. So just a couple more things here before we end this episode. Where do you want to go? I mean, this isn't necessarily the where do you see yourself in 5 years? It's more like where do you see yourself in, you know, 20 years if you were to stay in CRM? Like if you could do exactly what you wanted for in archaeology, maybe not even necessarily CRM, to be honest, but where do you want to see yourself going with this profession?
Ooh, that's kind of a tough question.
I know, there's so many paths. So,
well, I don't. Yeah, exactly, and it's difficult because I feel like I'm still very new, even though I'm not, but I am. So it's really tough to think about that answer. But if I had to give you one right now, I don't know. I kind of like doing what I'm doing now. I would love mm-hmm. to have more responsibility. I would love to be more involved in report writing. And I have had little experience doing that, mostly because I feel like when I have had those opportunities to work on different sections of a report, I read the entire thing because then I know what the project is. You know, I know the background of the project, what we're trying to do here. That's a big part of when you go out in the field. I like to know all that up front, like, well, yeah, what's here? What's supposed to be here? Who used to live here? You know, all of those things are covered in the background, right? I kind of wish that sometimes I would be able to read that prior. But then I go back to like my film, right? I said that I didn't really have a lot of interest in that, but creating like film on archaeology, as you guys mentioned before, because now you just like open this whole thing in my head now, and it's like reeling about doing like a documentary on archaeology for, I don't know, Nat Geo or History or any number of channels. But now that's sticking in my head, so I have no idea which direction I'm going now.
I was just going to say, just give you a little bit of advice. I think that, you know, you're doing a lot of the right things, putting yourself in a position that you become trusted and you end up in a position where you can start making these decisions. When you're working at a level where you're told exactly where you need to be, what you need to be doing, it makes it a little more difficult to be creative. And so, you know, continue to work hard at working your way up into a position where you're a full-time position and then maybe some kind of a management position where you can start injecting some of these ideas and people take you seriously. It takes a little time. It's obviously patience, but there's always that entrepreneurial side where you can, you know, start something on the side just like Chris did. But I think, you know, a lot of times people get frustrated. You know, you have life experience, so I think you understand, you know, you bring an idea to the table and sometimes people are not as enthusiastic about it as you are. They see you as an idealist and just, you know, not letting those naysayers get you down, but continue to, you know, work until you get into a position where you can make those decisions and you can, you know, be a little bit more creative with the product. And that's when it's so rewarding. It takes some time, but it's worth it.
You know, you said something about building trust, right? And moving forward that way. And I feel like in the the position that I'm in now with the company that I'm at, I've only been with this particular company for a year, and I was hired as on-call slash casual archaeologist. So, you know, work was intermittent to begin with when this season was just starting. And then I had the big section where I worked pretty much 6 days a week for 12-hour days. And then during the winter, it slowed down again. But maybe it's my experience, my life experience, but also my flexibility and schedule that over, let's see, at the beginning of winter, I was offered a permanent position. Now, it wasn't permanent permanent full-time, but it was permanent to where I was guaranteed hours, but not full-time hours. And within a month of that, I was offered permanent full-time. And that's with being with this company just a year. And as Chris mentioned earlier in this segment, or not this segment, but at the beginning of the show, I've only been doing this 2 years. So, yeah. And I still feel like I have a lot to learn, but I think it's that trust, the trust that I've built between my supervisor and I, and that I'm responsible. And, you know, I just had a mid-year check-in at my company, and she asked what I'm proud of, like things that I'm proud of that I've done on the job. And it's hard to say when you're just monitoring, right? Like, I'm proud that I found a thing, or that, you know, but I came up with things that I felt that were relevant, and this could be in any job. And it's, I was proud that I was at work a half an hour early every day, and that I did, you know, and I know those are like weird things that, not weird things, but they're things that are with every job, but they're just as important as, I don't know, finding, finding the big artifact, you know, or whatever. Those were the things that I was proud of, because I know there's plenty of people that are late all the time, or people like Chris who stop and get coffee and then get lost.
Amy, you're officially my favorite guest.
Awesome.
Called him out.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just those little things are things that I am proud of. I don't know. And so I think she was appreciated. Like, things like that is why I believe that I'm trusted enough to hold a full-time job now. So,
Chris, I just want to say one quick thing, because I know we're going to wrap up.
Yeah.
And that is that is your such an ideal example. There are so many people in this business that think, you know, this archaeology sucks, CRM sucks, because I can't get a full-time job. Anybody that got a full-time job, they must have done something, you know. No, you're doing all the right things. You're an asset to a company. You can't just sit around and wait for somebody to offer you a job. You have to go after it. You have to collect all this information. You have to show you're responsible. And you have to listen, when companies are hiring you full time, they're investing in you. And it's not just what they can bring you. It's what are you going to bring them? In fact, it's more so what are you going to bring them, because they're going to be giving you benefits. There's a lot more. They don't realize you get paid, let's say, you know, $50,000 a year, $20,000. You know, there's another $20,000 on top of that for benefits and all the stuff that goes along with. So it's not just a $50,000 investment for a company. It's a $70,000 investment. And they need to know that their investment is going to have a good return. And so, you know, you obviously have established that. And it's something that's really important, really, really important for people that, you know, our listeners to understand that if you want a full-time job, they're there. You can get them. They're not that elusive, but you have to prove yourself worthy.
All right. Well, on that note, I just got to ask one more really quick question. And it's because you said there was a bonus question here. I want to know about your almost bill sighting on a UC campus.
Okay. This was probably so funny. And it's like 100% embarrassing. So I don't even know why I put it on there as a question to be asked. So this is, I would drive for Uber and Lyft, because, you know, when you are doing like the casual on-call archaeology thing, you got to have some other form of income.
Of course.
So I was doing that for a while. I mean, there were some weeks that I was doing that full time because I didn't have other work, but I was on a UC campus to pick someone up, and I'm waiting like in this little roundabout area, which is the marker that they put there. And I see this guy walk by. Now, mind you, Bill... the only time I've never seen a picture of him, I've only heard his voice. And I heard this man walk by, and I heard his voice, And I literally like got out of my car and I was like, Bill. And the dude didn't turn around. And I was like, Dr. White. And still nothing. And I was like, hey, bro, turn around. And so he turns around when I said that. And I was like, hey, are you Bill White? And he's like, no.
No.
And this guy was carrying like a little box with like some probably posters. I don't know. They look like scrolls. And I'm like, oh, I'm not even on Berkeley's campus. I'm on UC Davis campus. This is not even the right school. And the guy I said that out loud and he goes, yeah. And he just turned around and walked away. And it was so embarrassing. Like I literally got out of my car. It was a moment. And then I just laughed at myself for like 5 minutes until the person. Yeah, it was fun.
I got to tell you, Bill is my favorite person to be at a conference with because he's a like 6'5" tall black man and he's easy to spot in a crowd because he just towers over everybody. And then his voice comes out and that laugh of his, it's just like, yeah. So I'd like to know who this guy really was because maybe he'd be good on a podcast because I love Bill's voice on a podcast. It's so deep and just sounds good to edit.
Yeah, oh, I don't know.
Man.
I didn't get the guy's name, so.
Nice, nice. All right, well, I think with that, we will end this show. Thanks, Amy, for coming on and for being a member of the Archaeology Podcast Network and supporting us and always leaving comments and just engaging. You often would join in on our live shows as well, which is really great. So anybody else who is interested in that, over to facebook.com/arcpodnet and follow us there, and you'll see when we go live. So
thank you, AB. It's been a pleasure.
Of course.
All right. Thanks, everybody, and we'll see you next time. That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.arcpodnet.com/CRMArcPodcast. Please comment and share anywhere you see the show. If you'd like us to answer a question in a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website or just email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Support the show and the network at arcpodnet.com/members. Get some swag and extra content while you're there. Send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about. Thanks to everyone for joining me this week. Thanks also to the listeners for tuning in, and we will see you in the field. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Thanks for listening.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.